This morning's call to worship is words by Susan McGinn. From beyond the playful summer clouds, beyond the earth's thin blue line, from beyond the bright moon and meteor showers, we hear the call to look and listen carefully, to turn away from a world that buys and sells happiness, to fully experience the luring whisper of your heart's truth. Why not today? Why not now? We are here and together at home in this evolving place, home in this ever-changing breath and body, home in this dewy morning even as it reaches toward a hot high noon. We hear the call from far beyond and deep within, and we do not hear it alone. Come, let us worship together. Our words for prayer or meditation this morning are a reading called Monuments by Stephen M. Schick. On this green bank, by this soft stream, we place with joy a votive stone, that memory may their deeds redeem when, like our sires, our sons are gone. Ralph Waldo Emerson. A green heron stands motionless on the bank of Emerson's soft stream. In its beak, it holds a fish, just the right size for this small cousin of the great blue heron. A feather-warming breeze rustles the nettles and the shoreline jewel weeds nod. The votive stone still stands not far away, asking us to remember those who died here on the first day of the American Revolution. My mind is disturbed by the gentle mingling of bird, water, fish, and history. Behind the heron is another sign. Perhaps you've seen one like it. No artist carved its design or chiseled its inscription. No poet was commissioned to write a hymn for the installation. Instead, unceremoniously placed, a bare steel shaft is embedded in mud. It holds a rectangular sign with the international warning symbol emblazoned over the picture of someone fishing. The stenciled words call to us for a new revolution. They read, "Warning, Mercury, do not eat the fish." Our next reading is titled "The Peace of Wild Things" by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting for their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
So, climate change, which is my topic this morning, is something that brings me a lot of despair most of the time. How many of you feel that way when thinking about our environment? Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming, isn't it? As someone who, especially who's not a scientist, I know that the subject feels immense and insurmountable. I don't really have a sense of what the world my child will inherit will look like, what the damage that has been done to our environment will mean for the world to come, and how much of it is still reversible. When the recent report came out from the UN saying that we have only 12 years to avoid the worst of climate disasters, I felt only greater despair at first. An article from CNN by Brandon Miller and Jay Croft explains the report, saying, "This is concerning because we know there are so many more problems if we exceed 1.5 degrees C global warming, including more heat waves and hot summers, greater sea level rise, and for many parts of the world, worse droughts and rainfall extremes," Andrew King, a lecturer and climate scientist at the University of Melbourne, said in a statement. They continue, global net emissions of carbon dioxide would need to fall by 45% from 2010 levels by 2030 and reach net zero around 2050 in order to keep the warming around 1.5 degrees C. Lowering emissions to this degree, while technically possible, would require widespread changes in energy, industry, buildings, transportation, and cities, the report says. Quote, the window on keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees C is closing rapidly, and the current emissions pledges made by signatories to the Paris Agreement do not add up to us achieving that goal, added King. When these reports came out, my first response was more despair. How overwhelming a goal and how short a timeline we have. With the sea levels rising, polar ice caps melting, extreme climate events happening, temperatures rising, the whole earth in crisis, how small and insignificant we are, and how is it possible to affect change? But it was a conversation with my daughter that helped me see in it a bit of hope. It reminded me of the fact that when I was growing up, I felt certain that nuclear war was imminent. We heard about how the nuclear arms race was proliferating. In social studies in school, we studied the numbers. This is the size of the USSR's arsenal. This is the size of ours. These are the cities that will get hit first. This is what nuclear fallout will look like. This is how quickly you will die. When I was in high school, the movie The Day After came out, basically showing us how devastating nuclear war would be, and it seemed that there was no sanity in our governments, and this was the way that the world would end. All of our culture was telling us stories of nuclear apocalypse and the end of the world. And yet, by the early days of college, things had changed, and our government had declared the Cold War over. And in talking with my daughter about climate change, while at first I heard only despair, my daughter had a different reaction. I heard this announcement that we had only 12 years to avoid the worst catastrophes, and she heard a measure of hope. We have 12 years still to avoid the worst of catastrophes. For all she had known, there wasn't any time left. For all she or I really knew or understood, we were headed certainly to a different apocalypse that was unavoidable. The idea that there was still some time to avoid the worst of changes, the worst outcomes, that was a sign of hope for her. The earth is so big, and we are so small. This is an easy subject to feel powerless on. But Margaret Mead once said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." That's a quote that I had hanging on my wall for over a decade, although it's packed in boxes right now. But I came back to that quote in thinking about this. It's easy to think that our individual actions don't really matter. What matters is only large corporate and governmental actions. But the truth is that small groups of people continually do build movements that change the world. 50 years ago, the Stonewall Rebellion started in a club in New York City. And today we have same-sex marriage as the law of the land. And while the fight isn't done, we have much more widespread acceptance of LGBT rights. Before the founding of our country, we had a small band of founding fathers who met and declared revolution. Examples of Margaret Mead's declaration about small groups of people changing the world abound. Every movement begins with a moment. Look back at where we were on climate change when I was a child, and it's clear we've come a long way. We've come a long way, both good and bad. Because while hybrid and electric vehicles, once just a dream, are now readily available with increasing numbers of Americans buying them, increasing numbers of households are able to outfit their homes with solar panels, once an option only for the very wealthiest of people. Recycling, something we only did with cans and bottles when I was a kid, is now something we do with almost all of our waste in our homes. Vegetarianism, while still a small minority of the population, has grown slightly, and recognition of it has grown a lot more. We've come a long way from where we once were. And yes, it doesn't match the population growth and the growth of carbon emissions that we've made at the same time. But an article in The Guardian by Rebecca Solnit talks about some places where that author finds hope in the overwhelming struggle against climate change. She writes, "The other thing I find most encouraging and even a little awe-inspiring is how profoundly the global energy landscape has already changed in this century. At the beginning of the 21st century, renewables were expensive, inefficient, infant technologies incapable of meeting our energy needs. In a revolution at least as profound as the Industrial Revolution, wind and solar energy engineering and manufacturing have changed everything. We now have a technological capacity to largely leave fossil fuels behind. It was not possible then. It is now. That is stunning and encouraging." And no, it's not enough. It's not nearly enough when matched against population growth and the corresponding increase in factories and red meat production and cars on the road. Our modest efforts have had little effect, but we have reached a point where we can turn the tide, I think. Because we have one new great hope in America. There's something on the horizon that is making younger Americans hopeful again and giving them something to fight for, and that's the Green New Deal. Now, I'm not here to tell you that this is a movement you have to support, or to tell you that it's perfect, or even to tell you that it's achievable. But what I do think is that it is something that is galvanizing people, getting them to talk about climate change, and getting the discussion on the table in a meaningful and real way that we haven't seen before. It's immense, it's ambitious, and it's something that will be a hard fight to pass. But it's also something that presidential candidates are endorsing and that young people are rallying behind, and has this something that has this country talking about climate change in a way we haven't been most recently. So those are some things that are bringing me hope at this moment. I want to give you a couple minutes to talk to each other. What is bringing, you all raised your hand practically and said you feel despair. Where are you finding hope with the issue of climate change? Just take a few minutes to talk to each other, and then I'm going to invite you to share your thoughts with the group as a whole. Okay, so tell me, where do you find sources of hope? What's hopeful for you? Shout it out. It's okay. I'll repeat back what I can hear. Technology, emerging technologies. Other sources of hope. What's big on solar? Germany's use of solar, yes. Yeah. What else? Young people taking an active interest. Corporations that are taking a responsibility for products all the way through the life cycle. Right to repair. Discovery of bacteria that eat plastic. Since 2001, we've had 2 to 3% reduction in CO2 emissions per year in the U.S. That's big. Yeah. Not just young people, but people of all ages learning more and paying attention to it. Yeah, amen to that. All sorts of people drawing the interdisciplinary links that impact climate change so that we see this as an intersectional issue, yes.
Awareness of carbon footprint.
Awareness of carbon footprint.
One of the things I saw recently was that Etsy, the website, now has a way to balance the carbon footprint.
When you buy something on Etsy now, you have a way to balance the carbon footprint of your purchase you make. Change in Chinese attitudes. As they move towards a middle-class society, they're having increasing awareness of environmental issues in China. Consciousness about local organic food coming more into mainstream. Yeah, definitely. Local communities working on banning plastic water bottles and plastic shopping bags. I know there's a movement in Acton to ban the bag right now, and that what 30 other communities in Massachusetts have done so. Yeah, that's amazing. No, zero communities back in Michigan. Yeah, a turning tide in political leadership that we're cautiously optimistic about to, for folks who get it, that climate change is real and important to look at. Yeah. I'm going to leave it on that note and say that we've been putting in your orders of service all week, or this week and all month this month, and for most of next month, you'll find little things that individuals can do. And sometimes there's a sense of pessimism about, like, what does my one action make? But to that, I'm going to close with these words by Marge Piercy. It's her poem, The Low Road, and it brings me hope in times of struggle. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through the mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen, make a demonstration. 100, fill a hall. 1,000, and you have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000, power and your own paper. 100,000, your own media. 10 million, your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more. So we, my small, thoughtful group of concerned citizens, we can and we will change the world. May it be so. Our closing words are by Harold Babcock. And now may we go forth in the certainty of faith, in the knowledge of love, and in the vision of hope. And in our going, may we be blessed with all good things on this day and forevermore. Amen.